This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
The goal of this podcast since day one is to provide the best information on the Vancouver real estate market at no cost to you, the listeners. To that end, we'd like to thank the following sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we have your real estate retirement plan simplified with Jenny Bayless and Chris Lopez. These are top-tier investors out of the Colorado area in the United States. And I am super happy. Did I just do a twang? I didn't even mean to do a twang.
And y'all gonna love it.
Y'all gonna love this episode. But seriously, these guys, we've just the hits keep coming. We had David Green on recently. Now we've got Jenny and Chris, and phenomenal advice.
Yeah, you know what? I said off air to you, I'm not a nationalist, or no, I am a nationalist.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I'm a Canadian nationalist, that's for sure. Yeah. But some of these top tier people we've had on from the States are like raising the bar. This is phenomenal guests. And the nice thing is they're operating in markets that are very similar to Vancouver, right? Like Colorado,
The
market's been on fire for the last 5-10 years. And their investing strategies have had to change. And we kind of walk through what they're doing and how it's changed over time and why, where the opportunities lie right now.
Yeah.
Really interesting conversation, as was with David Green in the Bay Area, where you know, the market conditions are very similar. So, and nice crossover, really great to get these guys' perspectives. And man, yeah, lots of useful
making
information.
Making you rethink your maple leaf tattoo. And I know what the maple leaf symbolizes, but what do the flames symbolize? That's the real question.
I was young.
Yeah. Anyways, but what else do we have before we get to this conversation with Jenny and Chris, Matt?
What else do we have? I'm just thinking of what that tattoo might look like. What else do we have? Well, it's a week before Christmas.
Right.
And
right.
This is...
And all through the house. Not a creature was stirring.
Yeah. It's a great time. I feel like all things considered,
it's a good time in life.
It's a pretty great week of the year. Yeah.
This
is still where kids are still in school. You still get up and leave the house,
right?
In our case, at least. But it's like your days, you're doing about what, 40%? I feel like we're rolling at about 40% this week.
Yeah.
It's to be cherished.
It is. It's going to be a cozy, I mean, I guess with everybody staying at home and spending time at home,
first of all, I think there's probably a lot of people consuming a lot of movies and books and television,
right,
media and
yeah,
that sort of
yeah
thing.
Well, hey, here's so one thing that has come out of this year,
right,
the other day, it was actually like I woke up and I thought, oh, I got a great idea. Like, it's, you know, I'm gonna go out,
yes,
buy A Christmas Carol, the Charles Dickens, you know,
movie.
Book. Charles Dickens book, and I'm going to read it out loud to my my family. And this
Wait,
is going to be a new
included?
Well, I, you know, and she might. Yeah, I was kind of like, I'll just read it, and they'll be enthralled by my.
This will be like a tradition where.
Yeah, this is
gets
a new
cozy.
Tradition I'm starting yeah. this year with my 9-year-old daughter, and if my wife wants to be involved, where I'm going to read.
Doesn't. Okay, but go on.
Where I'm going to read A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
So I went out 2 days ago. I bought it at a new bookstore in Hastings, Iron Dogs Books. Great, great bookstore. Anyway, bought the book, got home. You know, first off, I didn't realize this thing's 120 pages long, 120, yeah. 130 pages long. So, you know,
it's not that long.
Well, it's not. No, it's not that long if you're reading by yourself, but if you're reading out loud to a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
Over the course of 9 days, like I was like, man, this is going to be a bit of a slog here. Like,
yeah.
We're going to have to put in some serious time and energy to get through this.
Yeah, and she hates it probably.
Yeah,
right?
Well, no, yeah, she's not super excited about this whole tradition that I'm starting.
Yeah,
but so you know, the worst part is
right
is that. It's in Old English. Well, it's not probably not Old English, but it was written in 1830s, I think. Like,
definitely,
you know, I think I get the gist of it because of the cartoon, the Disney cartoon I've seen 1,000 times.
And your master's in literature.
That helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like Jacob Marley, da-da-da. Like, and it does, it hardly makes sense.
Right.
So yeah, a bit of a bust with my 9-year-old, but
yeah. You know what, though? The best thing about that is the best Christmas story, though. The like outside of maybe the Christmas story, but the movie The Christmas Story. But that is actually the best narrative, I guess? Or
yeah. Well, that's why I was thinking, like, let's go to the source. I've actually, you know, never read any Dickens.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed to say.
Yeah. The other thing is though, like, we just watched every year we do Scrooged. The Bill Murray movie, which is essentially that.
Yeah, same storyline.
And then this year, actually, somebody recommended it was The Family Man, the Nick Cage. Nick Cage. I kind of forgot about Nick Cage, but Nick Cage is...
he's a compelling,
it's good to have
compelling
him back.
Character on screen. That's for sure.
It was good to have him back in the household. But anyways, man.
I just watched Raising Arizona. Anyway, oh, yeah, go on.
Leaving Las Vegas. But anyways, he... You know what? That The Family Man is pretty good. And again... It's based off of
it's just that narrative.
Dickens.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I actually think that would be good to just, I'm sure there's a Reddit thread on this. Movies based on that story. And I bet there's like 10 or 15. Just do those.
It's
Christmas.
A classic, yeah.
So
what you're telling
they're
me
they're all
is,
the same. It's like the guy who's only worried about cash flow.
Yeah.
and his condos, who never spends time at home with his family. And then you need a ghost to point out what he's actually missing out on.
Right.
Which is his principal residence because it's tax-free. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding. But anyways, what else do we got?
What else do we got before we cut to our talk with Chris and Jenny? We have the Sellers Club.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people are not thinking of selling at this point in the year. That's
right.
For sure. And you shouldn't be. I mean, enjoy this time with your family.
Yeah.
But one thing I would do is sign up for the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast Sellers Club.
Yes.
This is still the hottest club in town.
It is.
Even at this point of the year.
Yeah. And you know what? The Sellers Club is all about getting you resources for free that will help you plan to get top dollar in the shortest amount of time when you sell your property. And really, it's a bit of a process. We have this one document called Start on Launch Date, which is the sold plan.
That's right.
And basically what you do is you pick a launch date and you work backwards, and we tell you exactly how to do that. So if you are thinking about listing in the new year, this is the time you want to get those resources so that you're ready. And get in touch if you're thinking about selling, because we can definitely help you with that.
Absolutely. We've talked to actually quite a few people over the last week that are talking about March.
Yes.
March, April even. So
exactly.
It's never too early. That is for sure.
Right.
Also, Adam,
This podcast is sponsored by Oakland Realty.
This is
our real estate brokerage. Head over to oakland.com/join and type in VRP 2020 if you're a new agent, an aspiring agent. Been around the block a couple times, but you're a little sick with where you're at. You're looking for a change. Oakland is where you want to be, or at least learn more. So once again, Adam, oakland.com/join VRP 2020. Tell them we sent you.
Huge holiday surprise is in it for you.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
For sure.
That's why you type in VRP 2020. You're right.
Exactly. But Matt, without further ado, why don't we cut to this conversation? Because this is one really, if you are an investor, if you're somebody that wants to build a real estate portfolio, I really think that Chris and Jenny do a great job of just simplifying things. And the advice here is invaluable for sure.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're here with Jenny Bayless, Colorado Springs investor-friendly realtor, and Chris Lopez, Denver investor-friendly realtor. How are you both doing today?
Doing great. Really doing glad to be here, so thank you guys.
Yes, thanks so much for having us on. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is kind of exciting because you guys have partnered up in Colorado, but you both work with investors, and you're very much in the investment game yourself. So thanks so much for taking the time today to speak with us.
Of course. I can't wait to talk real estate, and it's going to be fun for us to kind of just compare markets and talk shop. So I'm pumped.
Perfect. Perfect. Can you maybe start? Maybe we'll start with you, Chris. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So kind of give you the short story of it. Back in college, I was going on the traditional track of getting a degree, getting a good job, you know, that mantra. Somehow I ended up reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which opened my eyes to investing and entrepreneurship. And I read the book, I think my sophomore year of college, and realized that real estate investing was something I wanted to get into. And then after starting to read it and get into it, I realized not quite ready to invest in real estate as a, you know, 20-year-old with not much money in the bank. So I ended up focusing on entrepreneurship and then built a couple good online businesses, tried some day trading, and was just kind of going through, you know, my motions of learning business, learning investing, learning how to manage money, just all those things you have to learn, and had some successes, had my fair share of learning mistakes as well. And then, you know, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, it was time for me to move on from those businesses. And they were not real estate related, but I knew I always wanted to get into real estate. I come to the conclusion that I like being in, if I want to learn something, I like having a job or starting a business in that industry. I think it's the best way for me to learn. And so I wanted to learn how I could pivot into real estate. So it was time for me to have a new career, something that I was interested and passionate about. I kind of got burned out in my last business. So one thing I can be interested in that also makes sense in my long-term goals of learning real estate investing. So as I bounced around between some stuff, I did a fix and flip, made a few dollars, realized I did not care for that. Tried to help a friend do some wholesaling, and he's already a very successful flipper. Now I was trying to do some online marketing, realized that wasn't my cup of tea either. As well, and as I was learning about real estate and just talking to people, I realized that the long-term wealth-building mechanics was really my big interest, my big focus. And so I really wanted to make sure that my career was focused on something I could bring in income now, but that long-term focus. I definitely made a mistake when I was in my 20s, my new business, is I'd make a lot of money, and I didn't do a great job of investing it. So I wanted to have something that would, you know, merge the two with that long-term focus. So I realized that being an agent and focusing on the rental property aspect and doing that longer-term investing strategy, you know, 5 to 7 year plus holds, was a right fit for me. So ended up becoming an investor, getting some great traction in Denver, had some great mentors. And then, you know, I'll kind of let Jenny introduce herself, because as we're both on our paths, you know, we started working together, and just a great organic partnership for us to work together in Denver and the Springs.
Right on. And Jenny, can we hear a bit about your path?
Definitely. So I started out as an accountant by trade. So I did that for about 10 years. And starting in 2016, while I was still working, that's when I started investing in real estate, because the light bulb kind of went off that I wasn't going to really gain any wealth just by working a W-2 job. I needed to invest. So I started out of state, and then I actually started purchasing in-state in Colorado, Colorado Springs specifically. And from there, I've been investing in buy and hold properties ever since, and did it a variety of ways. I've worked with different financing options, procurement options. So those have been kind of fun to kind of vary that up a little bit along the way. And as Chris mentioned, about 2 years ago, I started working as a real estate agent. And then earlier this year, we linked up and now we're partnered up on the same team.
Right on. It's very rare you find or hear about agents who were accountants in a past life.
Yeah, it's very different.
Or accountants that are real estate investors. I guess that's, that's maybe okay. All right. So in thinking maybe, like, I'd love to hear why real estate, like why, how you both fell into real estate.
And maybe not so much as in terms of becoming agents, but more on the as a strategy to build wealth and get to that retirement that everybody's looking for.
Sure. I'll jump into this question first. So as I kind of mentioned, I was always trying to figure out how to make my. I learned the concept at a young age of like making your money work for you, and so it's always that was in my mind. So hey, how do I make my money work for me? I was right in that generation where defined pensions were going away and Social Security, great, it'll probably be there for us, but it's not going to be, you know, living a modest lifestyle as we get older. So I tried to do a lot of like active day trading because I realized, hey, there's more like passive investing and more active investing. So I spent like 2.5 years actively stock trading and then actively day trading on the currency market. And I realized there that like all the time I was putting in there wasn't getting me a good reward on my effort. And it was really just another job that was pretty low returns. I was not very good at, like most people. So that helped that as well. But it made me realize that, hey, I want to find something that feeds into longer term income. And also if I put my active energy in there, there's different levers I can pull. And with real estate, that's it. If I know, you know, you can follow trends, like on stock market, you have to follow trends within seconds or minutes and hopefully be right. In real estate, it's not so hard to see, okay, hey, great, this part of town's transitioning. What's the next neighborhood over there? Maybe I should just buy there as that starts transitioning. And then you can pull different levers for financing. You can raise rent, you can add value and be really more of an active investor, but at a slower pace so you can go out there and really learn it. So my interest came into how can I build a long-term real estate portfolio? And my goal is to have about $13,000 a month in paid off income, in real estate income for just real estate. And I figure $13,000 is a good number. And then I probably need about $10,000. My real goal is at $3,000 as buffer. So I always start with that end goal in mind. And as I was working back towards that goal, I realized, hey, everyone's exit strategy in real estate, whether you're just a regular realtor doing residential deals, whether you're a flipper, whether you're a wholesaler, whatever it is, like the exit strategy is having rental properties pay, you know, bringing in cash flow. So I said, hey, rather than having another type of investing strategy to generate that cash flow, let me just solely focus on rental investing. And that's where I really focused on is like learning mechanics of it. And then, you know, really learning how to adapt it to our current market, because there's lots of good information out there nationally from some, you know, great platforms and great educational websites. But after a few months of listening to that, it all comes down to, oh, okay, that 1% rule doesn't quite work in my market. How do I make it work? I'm not going to sit here for 5 years because other people are getting wealthy. So I started really learning how to adapt to the Denver market.
You know, and it's tough, but I it's tough talking to two separate people because I want to say, hey, Jenny, why real estate now? But just thinking, and maybe Jenny, you can jump in, but it might be worth kind of talking a bit more about your guys' market, because before we went live, we were saying, you know, there's a lot of other podcasts and real estate resources out there that talk about, you know, you mentioned the 1% rule and you know, different cap rates and cash flow that at least in Vancouver and actually in the province of British Columbia where we operate, it's just not possible. Like you, so if you're using resources and trying to, you know, wait to get into the market using some of those rules, you know, you'll be waiting a long time. Can we just talk a little bit more, I guess, about your guys' markets, what investments look like on the ground in terms of cap rates and cash flow, and then a little bit more about Jenny, why you're where you're operating, what it looks like, and why you were so excited about real estate after being in the accounting world.
I'll say this, and Jenny can go into more details. Like the Denver and Springs markets, like the trends are all very similar. Just Denver's a slightly higher price point, slightly higher expenses, and slightly higher rents, but all the ratios are practically, you know, pretty similar for cap rates, cash on cash returns, and just overall, like, you know, longer returns. So I'll just say that for Denver, then Jenny can jump into details and you can just, you know, add a few dollars to Denver and it's the same rates.
Okay.
I guess kind of jumping, you know, in the past a little bit, the reason why I picked Colorado Springs to invest in, and then I can also tell you why I like real estate in general. But I was actually living in a suburb of Denver when I first started investing in real estate. And I, you know, did some observations that, hey, Colorado Springs is a really vibrant market, but it's priced lower. So maybe I have a better chance of meeting this 1% rule, or maybe I have a better chance of getting a better deal because it's not quite as popular. Of course, this is about 4 years ago. And I think that everyone has started to catch on that, hey, Colorado Springs is an amazing place to invest. So our margins are definitely getting a lot tighter here. Prices are appreciating a lot. I think the last time I looked, it was about 10%. From last year, the median price keeps rising every single month. Same thing as you guys are seeing in Vancouver, really low supply, really high demand. So, you know, things are operating a little bit tight, but that's not to say that there aren't any deals out there. There definitely are. You just have to be a little bit more patient and, you know, look at kind of things from a holistic standpoint. Which, you know, that's kind of what we recommend that our investors do. In terms of numerically, I would say on average, the average MLS deal is looking at mid-5 cap.
Mid-5 cap, yeah, wow. Which is still pretty attractive compared to here.
What's your guys' average cap rate up there?
Average? Well, I mean, people are really excited about like a 4.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Like really excited.
Yeah, it's a tricky market, especially in the city of Vancouver, we should say. You can do better in surrounding areas for sure.
Can we talk, you know, I just am curious, Jenny, you mentioned kind of a holistic perspective. Can you kind of speak to that a bit and unpack that in terms of what you mean?
Yeah, and I can answer two questions at once with that. How's that sound? I can answer why I got into real estate investing. So for me, real estate investing has been attractive because not only is it something that you can actually tangibly see and hold, you know, but also because there's a lot of different components to it. So not only are you looking at the cash flow each month, and then, you know, at the end of 30 years when your mortgage is done, now you have a paid off asset. That's really cool, but that's only two components of it. You know, there's also tax savings involved, at least in the US there is. And then there's a potential for appreciation. And when you invest in a market that has really strong fundamentals for the economy, I think that it's probably pretty reasonable to expect a moderate appreciation each year. Of course, there will be fluctuations during certain times and everything, but if you kind of go into it in that mindset, I think that looking at those four components, so cash flow appreciation, tax savings, and loan pay down, that is a huge return that goes towards your initial investment. And then, of course, the best part about it is that you can utilize leverage to purchase the real estate. So if you're going to buy a $100,000 asset, I only have to pay $20,000 into it in order to own and control a $100,000 asset that's going to have all these benefits associated with it. And then to add another layer on top of that, it gets even more fun when you start doing more creative strategies such as BRRRR. For instance, now you can own a $100,000 asset with none of your cash into it. So it's just kind of it's really fun to strategize, and there's no one right way of pursuing this. So that's why I like it also.
And Jenny, we've had a lot of people over the years on our program talk about the Burr method. But for people that are not familiar with the Burr method, can you unpack that a bit?
Absolutely. So it stands for buy, renovate, rent, refinance, repeat. So it's basically a methodology of purchasing a property below market value, fixing it up. So you're doing basically a flip, but you're holding the property. So you've created equity through your rehab. You get it rented out at market rate now that it's in good condition, great condition. And then you turn around and refinance it so that since you've created additional equity through your rehab, you're able to pull out hopefully all or most of your initial capital contribution to that asset. And then the repeat is using that for another property and repeating that process.
And is that like, I know, so in thinking about both of your investment strategies, are you primarily using the Burr method?
So I had been, I had used it for 8 properties in Colorado Springs, but Chris and I were just talking about this not too long ago in that I've realized that, the tightness of Colorado Springs as a market, because I'm not going out there door knocking and, you know, spending hours a day on the acquisition side of things. I don't see much in terms of easily obtainable properties that would utilize the Burr method. So I haven't done it in about 1.5 to 2 years now, because the market is just not really amenable to that at this point for an average investor.
And are you still, but you're still in the last 2 years, what kind of investing are you doing?
So we've been primarily just looking at our assets that we've already done the Burr method on. So for instance, we just refinanced 3 properties that I had already done Burr on. I had already done a cash out refinance. We operated those properties very lean for the past couple of years, and they appraised for significantly more than what they appraised for 3 years ago. So we just pulled out more cash, and we're going to reinvest that cash proceeds into just essentially off-the-shelf type properties to invest in.
So just buying and holding, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm, exactly. We put up a lot of work up front, and we're just sort of reaping the benefits of it now in terms of simplicity and everything.
Nice. And Chris, I want to bring you back in here, because Denver is a more expensive market. And like, are you finding Burr method opportunities in Denver, or is that tricky as well?
No, I mean, it's similar to what Jenny is experiencing on the Springs. And so it seems like Denver is probably about 2 years ahead of Springs in terms of just like markets, you know, market trends. Denver is kind of like the leading edge of the ball or of the trend when it comes to the Front Range here in Colorado. And then Colorado Springs is right behind it. So we've been experiencing, it's been really hard to Burr here for, 4 or 5 years, just because we have such tight, we're such in like low inventory. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times we've been at like, you know, anywhere from about 1 to 2 months inventory. And for market house our size, we should be between about 5 to 6 months worth of inventory. So that's like 15,000-16,000 properties available on the market versus like 5,000 to 7,000, which we've been seeing. And so when you're in a seller's market, you know, everything tends to kind of trade towards a premium. And so it's very hard to find enough stuff, enough meat on the bones. And so there are people out there funding them, but what Jenny said, they are the investors who are spending $10,000 a month on marketing campaigns to market to owners directly. They've a lot of times got 1 or 2 deals, acquisitions, people, maybe a couple VA cold callers. It's really a lead generation business. And so for, you know, a newer investor, which a lot of our investors are, and I think a lot of your investors are as well, they're on the newer side, and they're more looking for that longer term retirement, not necessarily ready to start a business, to generate deals and do what they have to do to, like, you know, move quickly and invest all that money and capital up front. So a lot of our strategy is now is like, you know, buying a property that makes sense from a number standpoint. Like, hey, what's a good asset class right now that produces, you know, good cash flow in areas of town that are appreciating? And so really, like, we're seeing better cap rates in Denver in multifamilies and attached properties like condos and townhomes. Those tend to be from like a low 5 to low 6 cap rate. for a relatively turnkey property, where a lot of times like detached single family homes are a low 4 to a low 5 cap rate, unless you find a place with, you know, a mother-in-law suite or do some room by room rental strategy, which can often get in the, you know, some gray areas for zoning and permitting, all that stuff. So it has their pros and cons, but so a lot of people are buying a property that cash flows well. And we like to call it the Goldilocks phase right now, where if you remember your story from, you know, a little kid where Goldilocks, you know, the porridge was too hot, porridge was too cold, and it's just right. Denver, you can still buy properties that cash flow at a 20-25% down payment. And then also have a realistic expectation for appreciation. So we do, you know, variations just like trade up games of, hey, buy a property in an area where it's in a wave of growth, or, you know, and it's a good cash flow area, and then ride that growth. And then, in, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, a lot of times you'll see some good equity gain. And we're very big on like optimizing your total return on equity with our own investments and with our clients, and saying, great, if we're seeing, you know, a 3 to 6% appreciation, and it's been more than the last couple of years, and some debt pay down, a lot of times people have 100 to 200,000 or more of equity within 5 or 7 years. So great potential there then to cash out, refi, and then reinvest those proceeds if it makes sense. But also sometimes if a property value is appreciated so much, it makes the most sense to sell and actually do a 1031. And even with all the you know, transaction fees doing real estate, sometimes that 1031 is a better use of money. You can trade up from a property to a bigger unit to increase cash flow and re-leverage up. So I can give you a few examples on how detailed you guys want to go in, but yeah, that's like the longer term strategy that we focus on that works really well in our market.
We'd love to hear some examples, because honestly, the description of the Colorado markets you guys operate in sound very similar to Vancouver for a long time. Like the Burr method is very challenging here because supply is so low. And we've been kind of talking about what you just talked about, Chris, in this market for the last decade nearly. So yeah, examples would be great.
So I'll tell you one that I did personally, and this was one of my huge eye-opening experience to me and something my mentors really helped me learn. So I bought my first rental property ever. Is actually a house hack, is what we call it. You know, hey, live in the property, take your variable, the favorable financing, and then move out, convert to a rental. So I bought this property actually in Reno, Nevada in 2010, before I knew anything about real estate. I was still doing my own business. Just prices were so cheap. I was like, hey, I'm going to buy something. I would travel a lot. It'll be my storage unit. So me and my actually business partner, we bought it together, you know, for $67,000, and it was selling for $230,000, you know, pre-bubble. So just a huge drop off. Got very lucky on timing. Bought it as a foreclosure. We're like, hey, it's so cheap, we can't go wrong with it. Lived there for a couple of years, kind of our home base while we traveled, and then turned into a rental property. And it would make a few hundred dollars in cash flow every month. But my plan was to never sell this property. Because here's the crazy thing about this. I actually bought this property for a true 0% down payment. Because this was back, you know, right around the time, right after like the money markets froze and every bonds were returning, you know, nothing. The world was very risky and volatile. So one of our family friends, an older retired couple, was just looking to invest money for some stable income. And they gave us 100% financing, 15-year note at 5% down. Wish I bought 10 properties back then with that. But hey, bought one, made sense. It was truly 0% down. So I bought for so cheap, for 0% down. It was actually like an instant return on money. My first payment was not actually until that first mortgage payment, you know, 60 days later. So it was a truly infinite return on paper. Well, fast forward to like 2018, it appreciated from $67,000 to about $230,000. But rents had gone up from about $1,000 when I bought it to about $1,300. So, you know, a 30% increase in rent, but almost a triple increase in value. So I actually looked at doing a cash out refinance to pull some money out and reinvest it. But as I was doing it, and I started getting quotes for like, you know, a 15-year or 30-year cash out refi, I couldn't make sense of that. But every time I do it, the property becomes a negative cash flowing property. And it took me a while to understand that. And then I started, you know, running different analyses and realized that actually selling, doing 1031 is the best way, because I could pull out, you know, $150,000 on a cash out refi, but then it'd be negative like $3,000 a year in cash flow. So not a favorable thing, I think, like having a negative cash flowing asset to go out there and reinvest the money. So then I ended up selling a property, and my proceeds were about $175,000 after everything was said and done. And I had a realtor in Reno, Nevada to sell it for me. So we got a good offer, sold at fair market value, walked with $172,000. So I was making about $200 a year in cash flow, and then reinvest that into fourplex via 1031 exchange out here in Denver, where I was now making about $1,000 a month in cash flow. And so the two things I learned in this process was, you know, go out there and buy a higher cap rate property and re-leverage. Those were the key things. And even though I'm not looking for, you know, I want cash flow today, but I'm still working and just really building long-term cash flow. And I looked at it, great, I can make, you know, $100, $200 a month in cash flow now, or $800 to $1,000 a month in cash flow in the fourplex. But fast forward to when they both paid off, that condo would make me about $10,000 to $11,000 a year after property management, taxes, insurance, and typical operating expenses. That fourplex is going to make me right around $50,000 a year, or like the net operating income for both of them, the NOI. And so from a long-term standpoint, which one's going to get me closer to my my $13,000 a month income? Well, doing that 1031 trade up was what, you know, really moves the needle for me. Like, hey, me having $175,000 to invest takes me a lot of time to save up for my, you know, for my paycheck. So learning that game has been really great for my personal strategy and for our clients. And Jenny's doing the same thing down there, and she just did a round of cash out refi. So it's kind of looking at the property, and depending on how the property performs, interest rate environment, one is usually a clear winner than the other.
You know, just thinking about, you know, Chris, you were in Nevada. I know, Jenny, you started outside of Colorado, as I understand, or outside of the areas that you were living in at the time, correct? Jenny, can you talk a little bit about that process, about how you went about finding markets that were good for investing, and why you're investing closer to home now?
Yeah. So when I first started investing, I was actually living right outside of DC, which is extremely expensive area to invest in. So, you know, you just kind of start to hear, oh, 1% rule, this rule, that rule. And you kind of, if you're in an expensive market, you kind of automatically get drawn to the Midwest is pretty typical around here. So that's exactly what we did. So we invested in a few properties in the Midwest. That's probably a whole other story. But, you know, we just kind of, when we purchased a property in Colorado and we compared the performance between the in-state and the out-of-state, and then, of course, looking at that holistic perspective that I had mentioned previously, Colorado was the clear winner. So that's kind of when we kicked it into high gear and started investing in Colorado. But it's kind of tempting when you see paper returns elsewhere. And then it's interesting when you stop and think about, no, this is a, you know, probably a better market long-term close by, even if it appears as if it's more expensive or less profitable on paper. So that's just kind of how we pivoted between the two.
And I just want to kind of go back a little bit. That's we were talking kind of about how the Burr method doesn't work in kind of both of these markets now. And it sounds like a lot of what you're doing now is kind of recognizing gaps in the market or areas that are maybe kind of up and coming or where you think there's going to be some pretty good capital appreciation. How do you go about analyzing markets and finding those gaps?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think kind of what I look at is the opportunity of the asset not being used to its full capacity in its current state. So for instance, in Colorado Springs, there's a lot of properties that have really large rec rooms in the basement. And to me, that's a pretty easy win to turn that into another bedroom and bathroom, which will add more value than a rec room would have, but it's for, you know, just a few thousand dollars to add that wall. And, you know, there might be some more costs associated with plumbing and everything, but I think that that is an easy win. So looking at it from that perspective, and then as Chris mentioned, Denver is a really good opportunity for house hacking. That is probably a gap in the market in the sense that affordable rentals are getting harder and harder to find. So by utilizing the house hacking method, the owner of that property is able to basically, you know, provide housing at what would be a lower expense than if someone were to go out and get an apartment building or apartment unit by themselves while still being able to be a real estate investor actively.
Right. And so, okay, that from one perspective, it's focusing in on the actual asset, right? Maybe, Chris, can you speak to neighborhoods, how you're looking for areas of Denver, I guess, in your case, that are attractive and up and coming?
Sure. And I'll preface this because this is something that we talk with our clients about all the time. And it's balancing like, hey, you know, taking some of these rules, whether it's a 1% rule or I'm targeting a 5.5%, you know, cap rate or cash on cash. And then that's really the math and the science part. But how do you balance the art in there as well? Because those are, you know, you can't always translate these neighborhoods and these bigger trends into a spreadsheet. Or it's, you know, it's very hard to. But I'm a very much like a keep it simple, stupid person. That's one of my life mottos. And so I keep things very basic. And one of my things I focus on is the trend is your friend. Where are things trending? Where is population growth? Where is the path of development? Look at, you know, like in the United States, you know, we've got some federal programs like opportunity zones, which are some federal level tax credits or tax incentives for bigger money. Very similar to a 1031 exchange, but just you can actually get some amazing long-term tax benefits. And then there's some local, you know, state and city and citywide initiatives as well for trying to funnel money, redeveloping areas, you know, areas around hospitals that are redeveloping, and just also that next neighborhood. Like there are parts of town in Denver on the west side. If you look at like west of I-25, you go over there over the west, like there are areas that have popped there where a lot of houses have been purchased, they're scraped, and people put up duplexes to sell off individually through a party wall agreement. Great, you go to another neighborhood, well, people keep getting pushed out into that next area that's more affordable, and it transformed the area. So great, what are those areas that's the next neighborhood over? And you can literally drive up and down streets and see, oh, there's a dumpster. Oh, there's a place got knocked down, they're doing a new build, or they're scraping it, or they're popping the top. And so a lot of it's just very based on, hey, let's keep it simple. Where are things changing? Where are some of these overlays with tax incentives? Where are people moving to? Where is this big thing opening up around here? And a lot of times we see those areas transitioning. And I have a few rules too that, you know, we like to follow of, hey, if you buy a house, be at least three houses back from a busy street for ideal. Like right now, doesn't matter, you're gonna get top dollar. If your house is right on the freeway, it's marketed as, you know, convenient, easy access to the highway. Now, when the market eventually changes,
you might get hit by a car.
I mean, but that's kind of like the joke around here is, you know, hey, this is convenient freeway access. Your backyard is the freeway.
Yeah.
But
sounds like we're all realtors.
Will change. Yeah, it's going to be like that. So we look at things like that.
I love this idea of the art. We've never really framed it that way, but a lot of what we do on the podcast looking for kind of up-and-coming neighborhoods, and it is, right? It's that, yeah, a spreadsheet takes you only so far, but the art of the investing strategy is a great way to put it. In terms of education, obviously you guys are, I mean interested and involved in ongoing education. How do you guys approach that? Is there are there resources that you find most useful? Can you speak a little bit about how education factors into your business or your investing strategy?
So our philosophy for our team is to really be with the investor for the life cycle of their investing career. So we want to educate people on the basics of investing, whether we're talking about minutiae, something that a brand new investor may never have heard of a term or a concept. And then we like to also provide localized content on different strategies, different ways to grow wealth, different ways to look at your investment portfolio. And then something that Chris's brainchild recently is doing a portfolio analysis, and that's utilizing the same techniques that he mentioned in his Reno example to his trade up to his fourplex. So really just taking everything from a holistic, I keep using that word today, but a whole, you know, viewpoint of an investor, from getting them started to absolutely maximizing the performance of, you know, a multi-million dollar portfolio. So that's something that we really get excited about and helping people with.
Awesome. And Chris?
You know, we were both like, I'll say it from this standpoint, from this, we were both investors first and then became realtors to help our own, you know, career, own education, and because we enjoyed teaching, helping others. Like that's something that both Jenny and I really enjoy and why it's such a good partnership with what we have. And so, you know, we educate investors and it's really about like, hey, let's just, you know, go through this process. You can figure, hey, what are the numbers you want? And understanding that, hey, this market moves fast. So if a property looks good on the spreadsheet, if it, you know, you walk it, there's no major red flags, don't sit there and analyze it to the nth degree. If, you know, 90% looks great, we call it passes a sniff test. So that way we put the offer in and hopefully get under contract. But in Colorado, we have a state standardized contract and it's basically a fill in the blank for realtors. No attorneys are involved. So it's free for people to put off, for clients to put offers in. And there's numerous out points if, you know, for inspection reasons, HOA reasons, property insurance reasons, financing reasons, if the buyer can terminate and you know, get the earnest money back. So okay, if it passes the sniff test, put the offer in, then really do a deep dive into there. So with new investors, we have to really help them educate so that way they know like, hey, what's that good enough point? And hey, don't just go off this 5.75% cap rate. But hey, if we put this property in, we may have to go over ask, which a lot of times we do in this market. So if it's listed here and we go $10,000 more, understand what it does to your initial down payment, which often increases, you know, $500 to $1,000 initially, and your mortgage might go up by $30, $40 a month. Not a huge difference, but on paper, oh my gosh, $10,000 is a lot of money. So it's helping people understand like, hey, where what fits for their box, what fits for their returns, and understanding that, hey, as we when it comes time to an offers, we need to be nimble and act to act fast. So here's how to make a quick decision. And then once you're in a contract, we can slow it down, get all the due diligence, all the lending numbers, and then do a full underwriting and either, you know, kill the deal if it doesn't make sense or move forward with it. So we do a lot of education from that standpoint. And from that longer term standpoint, you know, Jenny and I, we'd like to geek out and support. Like, hey, let's learn about this. Let's do this. Let's figure out this. And so like our own interest for running models or running scenarios that also helps us out and helps our clients out. So it's really a blending of like helping our clients make decisions and also just me and Jenny getting to have the luxury and the fun of geeking out on details and spreadsheets.
Right, right. Can we talk a little bit about kind of pursuing financial independence? And it's clear that you both are working with a lot of investments or investors that are looking kind of more at like an overall retirement strategy or they want to build their portfolio. In kind of thinking of your mottos, keep it simple, stupid, Chris, are there any simple rules like when looking at, like a lot of our listeners are going to try and are trying to outline their path to financial independence, but I think a lot of people overcomplicate it in a lot of ways. Are there some simple rules when a kind of approaching building a portfolio?
Oh my gosh, yes. This is like one of the things that I love talking about, and how do you take this long abstract goal, identify it, and then simplify it. So you're here today. How do I make this line up with my goal in 2035? So I can tell you from the clients we talk with, 8 out of 10 people want $10,000 a month. That's the goal people are working towards. And often we ask people, they're like, I'm like, okay, $10,000 a month, what does that mean? Well, they don't know if that means paid off properties with mortgages. They haven't even thought that far ahead. So we say, hey, great. You want $10,000 a month. And usually the simplest method to go forward is what we have modeled numerous times to make some sense is go out there and acquire, and buy, and do the trade up or cash out refi. And then once you hit your gross number for rental income, then switch to maybe a debt pay down method, maybe sell a few properties that are your pains in the butt, but reposition your portfolio for like that next phase of your retirement. Which is almost like going from like a high stock allocation and minimizing that or lowering it and going to a higher bond allocation to make it a little bit less risky in terms of the stock market. That type of similar thought process. So here in Denver, if we want $10,000 a month in income, that really means I need $15,000 in gross rents on paid off properties. So our main rule of thumb, like Denver talks, or I'm sorry, Denver, the Bigger Pockets website talks about the 50% rule. That, hey, you know, for every dollar you take in rent, 50% will go towards operating expenses, which are all the expenses that aren't your mortgage debt. So in Denver, we often see properties between like 25 to about 35%. A dollar comes in, a third 20 to 35% covers operating expenses. So we use the 33% rule for very quick math. So if I want $10,000 a month, divide that by, 0.66 and you get $15,000. And then, so we get people focusing on that goal. And then that's the target they're working towards. That's the long-term game. And they have that area to work towards. And it's like, hey, we understand you're buying your first or second property. There's a lot of moving parts on here. So don't quite worry about your seventh chess move or your seventh house you're buying. Just say, hey, that's the target we're working towards. And every year, the thing you need to do is go out there and buy properties, get your foot in the game, and then keep buying more properties, and then analyze a property every year to make sure it's performing well, and eventually maybe optimize the equity by cash out refi or selling and trading up. But we like that 33% rule to kind of give that ballpark long-term net operating income goal that we work towards.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out again and again, and we've talked about it on the podcast, but really starting with that, with the goal, like it sounds like that's the first thing there is figure out an amount you want, cash flow every month, down the line, and kind of work backwards and develop the strategy from there.
Yeah. And that's been the simplest for us. And I think, and I've noticed like when I figured that out, it made me feel better. And we have literally talked to lots of clients when they have that, you can just see like their stress taken off their shoulders and they understand, like, oh yeah, I can achieve that. To achieve that, I need like 8 paid off properties, or I need usually 8 to 12 paid off properties. Like, that's very doable for someone over the next 10 to 15 years just to acquire 8 to 12 properties. You don't need 300 doors. You don't need, 3,000 units under syndication. You just need, hey, cool, 8 to 10 properties. That is very doable for the average investor, whether you're house hacking or you're just, working and saving your capital and buying properties when you can save up a 20% down payment. So it gives people that like that emotion they actually do it, which is very important. And then where that art comes into, like, hey, I can do this and it makes sense. And the other thing I'll say on here is when it comes time to look at properties, we've noticed people get a lot less tripped up over like, oh my gosh, this is a 5.5 cap rate versus a 5.7 cap rate. I'm not going to kill the property because of my hard and fast 5.75 cap rate. In the long run, this makes sense because it moves me towards that goal and helps people take action.
Right. And thinking about taking action, like, I'm curious about Denver specifically, because Denver and Colorado more generally, it seems like it's one of the hot spots in the U.S. and it has been for a while now. We're talking here about, I feel like a couple of the things that kind of have come up or are bubbling under the surface here are, analysis paralysis, not actually acting, and this idea of, hey, just start acquiring, like have the goal, start acquiring over the next 8 to 10 years. How do you guys approach kind of timing the market and specifically thinking that Colorado's been frothy for a while? Now you're talking about multiple offers and paying over asking price, which is kind of a fairly consistent thing that goes on here in Vancouver as well, and has been for years. But also specifically thinking about 2020, which is obviously an exceptionally uncertain time, and yet real estate seems to be performing so well. So can you talk a little bit about how you approach timing markets? Or do you at all?
Yeah. So I don't recommend timing the market. I don't think that you'll ever win doing so. I think that, I guess you probably hear a lot of people talk about the dollar cost averaging approach, just buying a property once a year, once every other year, and just basically de-risking it that way. So I wouldn't really necessarily worry about timing the market. I do make sure that properties are cash flowing. I think that's incredibly important, and it's the first layer of safety, I would call it. Chris and I have had a conversation about planning for the worst in case this is a bubble or something, which we don't think that it is, but just in case, I think it's important to have that cash flow to protect you from buffers in that stance. Also to have cash reserves. Also to make sure that you have equity, assuming that values hold. So we really just, kind of want to look at things from a safety perspective. And if if your property is safe in that respect, I would say move forward with it. And don't get tripped up over $10,000 here or there. It's not going to matter so much in the long run if you're positioning yourself from a position of strength, as well as having a long-term mindset on it.
Can we talk a little bit about the teams that you've built over time? Like, so who is on, like, in terms of your investments, are you managing these properties yourself, or do you have a property manager who's operating on your behalf? And can you talk about other members of your team when you're buying these investment properties?
Yeah, absolutely. So Chris wants to smack me every time I say this, but I self-manage my properties. So I like the sense of control that it gives me in terms of being able to make sure that we're selecting the optimal tenant to occupy the home. But in terms of rehabs or things that break down while the tenant is living over there, I do not do any of that myself. We outsource that to someone who's qualified to do so. So that's kind of the operating perspective for my portfolio. But I'll let Chris talk about how he does it, and then how our entire team is structured.
So there's two main things when it comes to managing the properties that's kind of made me a big advocate for myself and most for clients to get property management. My first one is I'm always about, like, I'm not worried about losing a few dollars here. I'm worried about, like, the big event that could, like, financially wipe me out, you know, a massive lawsuit for liability or being over leveraged, having enough cash from the bank. I'm worried about those things, not a couple dollars here and there a year. Like, you know, $100 a month right now is not going to make or break me. If it's going to make or break any real estate investors out there, you shouldn't be investing right now.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That small margin, that's just part of business. You can't pro forma that in there. So I look at, like, hey, a property manager, it minimizes my chance so I don't F things up, basically. So I don't do something silly. Like, in that very first condo I bought, I moved out, and that was the one time I self-managed. And I said, no pets. And then someone applied with a service animal. And my initial reaction was like, oh, that's a pet. I don't want it. Well, in the U.S., that's not a pet. That's a service. That's a American with Disabilities Act. It's the same thing as the wheelchair for people that they need to get around. So that can be, you know, a big fine. And also, it's just not right for the person as well. So that was a scary moment for me. Like, you know what? I need to make sure I don't just screw it up on here. The other thing is, you know, I can manage all my properties within, you know, usually like 10 minutes a month with a few text messages and emails, a quick phone call with my property managers. Now, if I manage it myself, I get about, you know, one more month's worth a year, you know, because in Denver, it's usually about, to ballpark it, like, if you hire property management, they'll take about 1 month of rent per year per property to cover their fees and lease up fees. Well, for me to have to then, you know, deal with more, you know, tenant showings, tenant screenings, this or that, it's, you know, it will take some more time. It's also all that mental energy I put out there as well. So I have two young kids. I'm very busy with my real estate business as well. So for me, that maximizes my overall return, where, hey, I get more time to either enjoy life or go out there and continue to build our business, which is a greater return on my time and just overall money as well. So those are two things I really look at. And I find a lot of investors too, like, the other thing is, like, long-term, how do you scale? And you can only self-manage so many units until you hit a point where, hey, you have to bring in someone or self-manage. And to go to a very, like, take a left turn to very, like, sober moment for me as well, and just life in general, is, like, one of my mentors out here, name is Charles Roberts. Like, he was my main mentor out here in Denver, and just a very successful investor, agent. He helped build the brokerage that Judy and I are at. He's just been, like, a pillar in the investing community for, like, 15 to 20 years. Well, a couple of years ago, he had a brain aneurysm, you know, which was not planned for, and they were self-managing their properties, and there are all sorts of issues. And again, that minimized my risk. Like, I never want to, but I worry about the, like, hey, I drive home and hit by a bus. What does my family do? And that minimizes that longer term, like, risk for me, and makes me not lay awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, like, worrying about, you know, these one in a million events as well, which is what my mind does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are some great answers. Maybe kind of wrapping up here, we've talked a little bit about education, and I know it helps. We're the same as you guys, like, on the ground realtors, which I think is, like, just by the nature of the business, is kind of an ongoing education day in, day out of what's going on and market trends and everything else. But is there a book you would recommend anyone listens to, like the first book they should read or the best book they should read?
So I absolutely love the two books that come to mind first is Cashflow Quadrant and then the book on managing rental properties, because I like to self-manage. And I think that that book was kind of more of a tactical approach to everything. Whereas Cashflow Quadrant was interesting because it opened my eyes to kind of the different types of ways of operating, you know, either as a business, an investor, self-employed or employee. And it was just kind of eye-opening as I was in the E quadrant at that point, hoping to jump into the I. I guess now I've moved down to the S, so we'll see. We'll see eventually when I can get ever to that B quadrant. But I thought those were pretty interesting.
Right on, Chris.
So I turned around and looked at my bookshelf because I think obviously, you know, is indicative to where I'm at life right now. I agree with Jenny. Like, Rich Dad Poor Dad Cashflow Quadrant is a great book. Little lacking on details, but it's great for that conceptual mindset shift. But I think a great book is just Set for Life by Scott Trench, who's the CEO of Bigger Pockets now. I like this because, you know, this is one of the few books that actually kind of takes, you know, talks about the whole global financial picture for individuals, with real estate being a big component. But I think that's a really good, like, high level overview for people kind of get, help them figure out for their budgeting, their real estate investing, their stock and, you know, their stock investing, all that. I think that's a phenomenal book for people to read.
Both great recommendations. What is one piece of advice that you would give your 18-year-old self?
That is like literally my favorite question. So
well, maybe we'll start with you then, Chris.
Yeah. But I always ask that question. I've never been asked that myself. So this is going to put me in the spotlight. I like it. I think my 18-year-old self has just realized, you're 18, life is really, really long. So really think long term and just really be patient and realize that, hey, it's hard to get rich in 5 years. It's a lot easier to get rich in 20 years. So really be patient and know that, you know, play the long game when it comes to investing and just life in general, but really be patient, play the long game.
Right on. And Jenny?
So I think mine's probably a little bit narrowly focused, more so than Chris's, but you know, I think back to when I was in college, and if I was 18 and knew about the concept of house hacking, I think that my life would have been dramatically different than it is now, at least from a financial standpoint. I think that would have been a powerful way to kind of propel early adulthood, I think.
I agree with that a lot, Jenny. I may change my answer now. The math is hard to beat on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put my hat in your camp, Jenny. I like that.
Me too. Last question for you guys. What is something that you've purchased in the last year or two for under $1,000 that has greatly improved or transformed your life?
Can I take this to total left turn direction? This is the first thing that popped in my mind.
Yeah, totally.
I'm very much the mantra of like trying to simplify things. Actually, the best thing for me was, you know, I bought the new iPhone for around $1,100 2 years ago. The best thing I started doing about 18 months ago is I completely deleted social media. I took emails off my phone and I truly use it for phone calls, text messaging, and GPS. And that greatly reduced my stress and allowed me to like get more work done and actually spend higher quality time with my family. So from like a high level thing for just like the biggest thing I've done, that's been it. Because nothing monetarily passed my mind, but it's actually taking something away that actually improved my quality of life and investing.
So just so I understand, you've taken email off your phone as well?
Oh, yeah. Cool. I've taken email off my phone. I've taken social media off my phone because I found what happened with email was I would often be like, you know, getting ready to record a podcast or home with my kids, and I would open my email. And all the emails I get, it's hard for me to respond on my phone because it might be a spreadsheet to review. I have to pull up a property and I review it, read the email. I can't do anything about it and kind of get my mind in two places.
Yeah.
So reviewing and getting rid of has actually allowed me. So now I block out time a couple times a day to check my emails and respond to text messages, but it's allowed me to be a lot more efficient through my workflow and just really reduce my stress and mental clutter, and just made me, my wife will tell you, a happier person, a lot less stressful and snappy.
Well, I bet with social media, like I feel like I'm kind of maybe a tenth of the way to where I need to be, which is deleting that entirely. But
still very snappy.
Yeah, but I've put a limit on a 15-minute limit, I think, a day on Twitter, yeah. Which I consistently go over. But man, it every time I look at that, it makes me unhappy. I'm not sure why I Twitter. Keep doing it. Twitter specifically, but
a lot of negativity on Twitter.
A lot of
anxiety. Well, there's a lot of negativity everywhere. And I used to try to do that with emails and social media, but I realized like I simply can't do it.
Right.
Whether, you know, because I think they do program those things to be addictive. But I realized, you know what, like I keep saying I'll do this, I can't do it. So I just need to like I'm either all in or all out. I have a very hard time like living in the middle and putting boundaries on myself. So I'm just like, I got to completely get rid of it. And I went through like 60 days of pretty hardcore withdrawal. Like it was very interesting. But it's been phenomenal from a quality of life and just like a business standpoint. And I think it's actually worked out better for clients as well, because when I do talk with them or communicate with them, I'm 100% focused on them, either on the phone call or responding to their email. And it's total, you know, all my focus right then and there on them.
And just, I'm just curious, Chris, do you actually now not having social media on your phone, do you actually use social media like on your computer or your laptop?
You spend a lot more time on your laptop?
No. I spend a lot of time on my laptop in general doing just, you know, all this stuff. But it's almost like I probably log on social media like maybe at most once a month.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, and just because the only reason I still have a Facebook account is so I can have a Facebook page and an Instagram business page and actually run ads on there. If I didn't, I would delete those.
Yeah.
The one social site I spend time on is BiggerPockets. I love their their forum feature on there, because that is more like it's all real estate. I don't get sucked into like people from high school or silly political drama going on Facebook. I just get to talk real estate that's focused on Denver and some other keywords I like. And I get to like share my thoughts, reach from other people. And that's the one social media channel I really do enjoy, because it's longer form content. And it's also completely focused on real estate, and it's generally positive news,
right?
Or like, you know, critical thinking skills. So that's the one side I spend time on.
Wow. We were talking about actionable items before we went live here. And the one that I'm taking away in the next 10 minutes after this call is I'm deleting some stuff from my phone.
been inspired.
I've been inspired. What about you, Jenny?
Oh, mine's a lot less profound and way more materialistic than Chris's answer. But I was thinking while he was talking about something that has been purchased in the past year that I, you know, that has made a change in my life. And it's a little silly, but I would say the baby Brezza. It's a like basically a Keurig for babies, baby formula. And that has saved me a lot of frustration and added back some sleep. So that would be my answer for that.
Wow. I've never heard of that. I have a 1.5 year old, and what's it called?
It's a little late for you maybe.
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah. Baby Brezza.
Baby Brezza. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's a great one too. Perfect.
I don't know if I can put that into action in the next 10 minutes, but
both have inspired Matt. So let's maybe end on how can people, a lot of people from our who listen to our program are definitely going to want to follow you and kind of see what you guys are doing and possibly get in touch. So how can people get in touch with you, Jenny and Chris?
I would say the easiest way is just, I mean, we're an open book with everything. We publish a lot of the content on the website. So just envisionrea.com. So envisionrea for real estate advisors. Envisionrea.com is a great content on there, or great content on there. And then also you can just email Chris at envisionrea or Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y at envisionrea, and they can email both of us.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, guys. That was a really enjoyable and insightful conversation. And I think our listeners are really going to take away a lot. And thanks so much for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
This was fun. Thank you so
much. Yeah.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Jenny Bayless and Chris Lopez.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Chris and Jenny. And I think that having people like them, like upbeat, energetic investors, it's inspirational.
Inspirational. Great. Just great talking to them, man. Energy matters.
Yeah, energy definitely matters. And the other thing is that immediately after we had them on the show, you deleted social media from your phone.
I did. We talked to these guys almost a month ago now. So right. I would say
you're 5 or 6
at
weeks.
At some
almost.
Point in November, after we hung up from that call, I deleted Instagram,
yep,
Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, the YouTube app. Yeah. Don't ask me why. I deleted all that. I still have my email and everything, but
right.
And I have not been the two worst offenders, I would say, are Twitter for me and Instagram in terms of time wasters, and Twitter making you feel like just terrible.
Yeah. Twitter sucks.
I have not been on either of them for over a month, even on a desktop, and I can say not only do I not miss them, much happier.
Instagram is another thing too. I think neither of us are big on Instagram, but I do feel the need
business,
to like
really a
watch, just click on those stories. Like, it's not a thing really.
Yeah. The death, what do they call that? The something scroll on Twitter where you just constantly reloading.
But
while
you're doing other stuff. Right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
It's like a forced multitask thing that doesn't make sense.
And a time waster. And I actually find now that I'm looking at my phone going like, oh, I actually have nothing.
No emails.
Nothing left.
Nobody
to do
called.
Here. Nothing. Like, what's wrong with this?
Yeah,
what's wrong? But I'm not staring at it. And, you know, no news is good news in my mind right now. So
yeah.
It's been a huge change. So I'd encourage everybody. At
I
least
might
over
do
the
it
holidays,
in the new year.
At least over. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Come on. The new year.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. Do it over the holidays.
Yeah, Matt, definitely delete social media, but also head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, we don't have an app, so focus on VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is where all things real estate live. We have things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer. This is where you get stats before anyone else, stats that you can't get from the real estate board, submarkets, price bands. We also have the deal of the month.
Yes.
There's no reason why you don't want to be on this list. We also have tried and true private client services.
And Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information. It is our gift to you.
In
Merry
this
Christmas.
Holiday season. Yeah.
Happy holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. If you want to talk about that, the Sellers Club, PCS, the LiveWire, anything real estate at all, or anything really, give me a call, 778-847-2854, or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574, or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that secret line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
So stay safe, everyone. Stay home and enjoy the holidays, and we will see you next week.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.